Hello and welcome to The Price of Music, the show that looks at the money behind the music industry with me, Steve Lamack, and Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge. This episode, having covered some news stories in the last pod, this episode we're going to dedicate to some of the many questions that we've received so far from yourselves. Thank you to everyone who's been in touch with queries. We will do this on a regular basis from here on in if we can. So if your question isn't answered on this edition, don't worry, it should be in coming weeks. And of course, if you'd like to send us a question, email us theprice of music podcast@gmail.com to start. Question from Ricky Kenny. Typically, how is the money distributed between headliners and supporting acts? And who actually pays the support band? Shall I, in my position as man who stands at the bar at live gigs and should know something about this, shall I try and do this one?
I think it's one for you, yeah.
I say that, but this is going to sound a bit woolly, probably, Ricky. But simply put, there isn't really a typical distribution because it all comes down to what an artist is worth. So a promoter predicts how many tickets a band might sell. Then they find a venue, they negotiate a fee with the band, set the ticket price, put the gig on, worked out just what the value is of the headliners. And that's what produces the headliner's fee. And then the support bands, you can usually split these into, I guess there's kind of two definitions. They're either a quite new artist that no one's probably really heard of, or it could be a band with some profile who are on the way up, and whichever one of those you are, that will affect how much money you get, because as an unknown band, you're not going to really add to any of the ticket sales, so therefore you have less value to the promoter. But a group who've got some profile, maybe had some plays on the radio, who might actually help bolster the number of people in the crowd, then you'll get a little bit more money as a support band. I did go and check this once again with my friendly Live Music Insider, who said, and I quote, obviously the bigger the show, the bigger the fees can be for a support act as they become worth tickets, in inverted commas, thus actually adding to the show's worth, and so they're paid accordingly. But at the smaller level, when they're virtually unknown, it's a very small fee that should cover a support band's costs, but in reality these days often doesn't. So there you go. There are no, simply, there's no rule as to how the money is split. But all the monies to the headliners and the supports are paid for by the promoter. There are one or two exceptions. I don't want to complicate matters now, but there are a few exceptions where headliners have helped finance a band to support them because they really want them to go on tour with them. Because they want them to do it, they'll put a few bob in so that the band can pay for a hotel or, you know, hire a decent van. So that occasionally happens. Even more occasionally these days, I think, a support act, if they're signed to a bigger label, that record label might pay the group what's called tour support, which is the label adding some money to the kitty, to the tour kitty, to help the band get out and play and raise their profile and win new fans. Although I don't think that happens as much as it used to in the 90s, but I think it possibly occasionally does. That's tour support. There is, if you can put that on its head though, Stuart, what's the other one?
Yeah, buy-ons. So I was a naive young journalist who was like, that I thought that's how everything worked. Like, as a band, you're like, who do you want to support us on our tour? Let's get them in. We love them. We'll pay them some money. That's it. And then someone said, yeah, you know, buy-ons, sometimes you pay to go on, you pay for a support slot. You have to kind of, you know, if you don't put the fee up, you can't go on the tour. And I was like, oh, my eyes were open to the music industry. But I don't know if that happened. Is that common now? I don't know.
I haven't heard of it. so much of late, but that could be just because I haven't heard of it. Doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't happen. Again, it's one of those things that certainly did happen an awful lot in the 90s, where, I won't say the name of the band, but I was incredibly taken aback when a well-known Britpop group were reportedly charging £20,000 for a band to go on tour with them. How about that? But there was a lot of money in the music industry in them days. Question from Darren Luckhurst. Pet Needs, this is the band Pet Needs, who are from Colchester, by the way, just a stick that in. Pet Needs have just released their third album, Intermittent Fast Living. And as is the way with modern day music, it's arriving on multiple formats. The band are currently running a Bottom of the Pops campaign in a bid to reach the UK top 40, whereby the push is for fans to buy 12 copies each of the new album, which all come in unique sleeves, which when put together eventually forms a piece of frameable art. So there's 12 different versions of the album. If you collect the set, it turns into a piece of art. My question, says Darren, is this of major benefit to the artists in terms of profile and chart sales? Is it a major benefit? Is it even allowed, Stuart?
Yeah, well, so I thought I knew the answer. Similar to you, I thought I knew the answer to this, but I went and asked someone who did know. So I went to the official charts company to check I had it right. So that there is a real benefit to buying versus streaming in terms of chart sales still. So I think if you sell an album, whether it's like a CD or a vinyl record or download, that's equivalent to around 1,000 track streams from the album in terms of the chart. So on a 10-track album, that's 100 plays. So you buy the album, it's worth 100 plays of the full album on streaming. So there is a real merit in about an artist going, right, for week one, we want to sell albums, so get the fans, get the main list on the case, we've got this coming out, and that's been around for a while. So there's a real benefit in chart sales of actually sales versus streams. And yeah, it's increasingly common and it is allowed. I mean, Pet Needs have kind of pushed the boat out, I think, to a level that you see with artists like Taylor Swift. She has loads of versions of her Midnight's album, for example, but you don't always see it from kind of young bands. So they've really kind of done something quite fun here. It's all fine under chart rules, as long as you don't do anything sneaky. So you're not allowed to go buy all 12 versions of the album for a tenner and I get 10, you know, 12 sales for a tenner. That's right. Not allowed.
Right.
And one fan buying 12 different versions of an album is fine. So that's all counted. One fan buying 10 copies of the same version is not counted as 10 sales. So you can't kind of encourage fans to buy 10 copies of your CD. That won't be counted if they buy them from the same place. Like, they'd have to go around and buy them from different retailers to, you know, make it.
I mean, surely you just stand in the shop, don't you, and go, I'd like 12 copies, please. 11 of these are for my friends.
And take that down when you report it to the chart authorities.
Yeah. So when you say Taylor Swift did this, I mean, as you say, it's becoming more and more of an accepted part of the chart race, isn't it? Or get a way of generating revenue by getting people to buy more than one copy of the record. But what is the record of most number of how many formats did Taylor Swift do? Do you know?
So off the top of my head, I think it was around 19, but
19.
stuff comes out after the event as well. Like, you know, a few months later, you might have a deluxe. So I'm not sure of the final number. But I think the other thing about Pet Needs that I thought was interesting is they're not just saying buy 12 copies of our album to fans. They're doing, I think it's like 9 in-store shows in a week. They're doing loads of in-store shows around the country. They're really good on social media. It's like a big concerted campaign. It's not just buy 12 copies. And that, I think, is what backs this up. Because if you just kind of try and make people pay, I mean, who cares, really? But if what they're really kind of trying to engage their community in that goal. Although I kind of, Bottom of the Pops is quite fun. But I don't know. I mean, you saw the midweeks figure. Like, I think that if they're trying to come bottom of the top 40, they're not doing very well. They've failed in that. How are they doing?
Well, so we're recording this during the week. The album is out. By the time this episode goes live, it will be on Friday, which is the day we'll actually find out their final chart placing. But they were doing quite well. They're inside the top 20 at the moment. So it does seem to be working. I'll tell you what else this also brings us back to the last pod we did, where we were talking about the concept of the superfan, because this is classic superfan territory, isn't it? I mean, I wouldn't class myself a superfan of anyone, but I have been tempted by different versions of the same LP release, if you see what I mean, different formats. When you see, oh, that's a lovely looking red vinyl, marbled red vinyl, and oh, but this one's in gold, and this one's, and there's a picture of this, and there's this, and this one comes with a set of postcards, and that'd be nice to have, wouldn't it? But that's the land of the super fan. You're basing your marketing on a select group of your biggest followers.
Yeah, and also bringing them into it. So it's like not just buy my stuff. It's kind of let's do this, let's achieve this goal together. Like let's kind of get together and get the band in shape. I mean, I feel like it's been going on since I was young as well. Like let's get our band into the charts that we love. Mm. It's always been the case. And yeah, so this is just a good example. But yeah, so nothing against the rules, very inventive and seems to be working well. And now I think the case is when you get the early midweeks thing, you have to then keep the momentum up, and sometimes that can boost you, can't it? Because you can say, right, we've done it, we're inside top 20, let's keep this going till Friday. So yeah, best of luck to them, and we'll know by the time this comes out.
Just in case anyone doesn't know, so inside the music industry, there are charts compiled. Obviously, the data is coming in on a daily basis. And if you're a subscriber, you can get what's called the midweek charts, and the charts are updated every day. So you can plot your marketing campaign. You can plot the campaign of the band from the very first midweek all the way through. So it's actually not even a midweek. It's a start of the week, a midweek, and a nearly end of the week. You can get all the positions. I will say that, I mean, the interesting thing is what it does do is, you know, it doubles your fan base immediately if you can get one person to buy even one extra copy, doesn't it? So it does that. And in answer to the other part of your question, Darren, you know, what is a band, what's it worth to a band? It's worth a line in the next press release. You know, if you can include the line from the top five album, or following the debut LP, which went top 20. That's the sort of thing which often makes, you know, some journalists and radio producers and people in the media take notice. It's a sort of statistical endorsement, isn't it? It's in some ways, unfortunately, better than saying after their terrific record, the best work of their career, just stick a top 10 in that press release. And it's, you know, it looks like they've had a successful record, even if it was only top 10 for 1 week. Bless them, Pet Needs. As I say, good luck to them, and not just because they come from Colchester either. we'll update you on where they ended up in the charts next time around. Now, can I, just before we go on to the next question, can I do a very quick update on a question which we answered, I think it was last week, as to who's the most successful songwriter, Noel Gallagher or Damon Albarn? Because I had a message from a friend who shall remain nameless, but is involved in the music industry in various guises, and he proffered this additional insight which we hadn't thought of at the time, because we compared physical sales of the albums and both their streaming stats, taking into account, you know, all the artists, although we did forget to mention Good, Bad and the Queen actually for Damon Albarn. But this is the point. This is my contact who says, if you're talking about who has the highest value, you need to add in Blur's track Song 2. It's the sound of NFL touchdowns, and its use in sports in America is extraordinary. I'd say that the comparative streaming numbers are pretty much irrelevant compared to the value of Song 2's placements and broadcast usage, which, as I say, is a twist I hadn't thought of, but we should probably, I mean, we'll probably explain this properly at some point down the line. But artists, they get paid for the use of their songs, I mean, not just on TV and in films, but also at live events. That's a given, isn't it? So repeated use of your track, even at a sports event, will bring you some money.
Yeah. And do you remember when Taylor Swift and Damon Albarn fell out because he said something about co-writing? And now she's going to all these NFL games because her partner is an NFL player. Right. So I mean, she has to listen to song two every time her partner catches a touchdown. the song of one of her nemesis is played. That's kind of harsh, isn't it? But yeah, I didn't think about that.
Yeah, but every time song two is used, as I say, in this case in the NFL, the writers of that song, so e.g. Blur will get a payment every time it's used. And given the amount of times it's getting played during games across the season over multiple years, that is going to be a tidy little sum of money. Thank you very much. As I say, we're always open to further insights into any of the stories we cover or the answers we give. The email address is coming up after this. Our final question for now, which is, well, less a factual question, and I guess more of a moral one. This is from Graham Colbeck, who says, I've been listening to your chat about the 45 million tracks not played at all on Spotify. This, in case you missed it from a couple of weeks ago, from a report which said just that 45 million tracks didn't have a single play, didn't get a single play last year on Spotify. But Graham says, yes, the 45 million tracks not played at all on Spotify, and then heard you trying to put a positive spin around not paying artists who have less than 1,000 plays a month. I'm not sure we did that. Graham, I refer you all back to last week's Spotify pod. But Graham continues, I'm an amateur hobby artist, and I gather a very small amount of plays on Spotify, but I have to pay for my tracks to get on the streaming services, to be distributed to the streaming services. But I do this because I want my art to be out there for its own sake. I create my own music, and some people listen. Am I not entitled to receive anything towards that distribution cost of £20? It doesn't seem to be an unreasonable request, does it? By the way, my artist alter ego is Grizzly Adams, if you want to look up Grizzly Adams. What are your thoughts, Stuart?
Yeah, well, I listened to his album this morning.
Did you?
And I liked it. So it's just 10 streams for me, just to kind of show willing, really. I think I agree. I don't think we tried to put positive spin in. I think we were kind of explaining why this is being introduced and what the arguments are in favor of it as a way of explaining it. But then I understand if you're an artist and you're thinking, hang on a minute, this is my art. Mm. I can understand why you might be. So it's, I think it's two things, isn't it? Like, it's, do you have the right to put music out, and do you have the right to get paid for it? And these two things are kind of being separated out now, in that Spotify is not taking anyone's music off its service, but it is setting this threshold for, well, you only earn if you get more than this. And it's kind of, I suppose it's like, this is the modern thing, isn't it? Like, it's been, ever since the internet, it's become much easier to release music. You didn't need to have a label. You could put your music on MySpace, you could upload it to SoundCloud, put it on YouTube, and now you can pay for distribution like Graham is and put it on all these things. But there is this move now of saying, right, well, how few plays are too few plays to get paid for it? And that's I'm torn between worrying about that and seeing where they're coming from. I don't know about you.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to play devil's advocate, but this is a business versus art debate, isn't it? And I think we're all in favour of people who create art being paid for their art. Certainly if somebody else makes any money out of something which you have created, then you should get paid too. I guess Spotify's argument is going to be that, you know, they're sort of hosting your music for free, although you've had to pay £20 to what's the distribution company? DistroKid, I think. So Graham, you've had to pay them £20. But I guess they're saying, well, you know, our bit is just providing you with a platform to be heard. And that's why, I guess, if they think they're not getting much out of this deal, that's why they're not giving you anything back. But in general, creatives who create something which is used and other people enjoy, you know, well, I think we all agree that somebody, you know, who's spent time on their art, as I say, if it generates anything for anybody else, then you should get paid. But I'm with you all the way on this. Where could this stop? And I know Spotify have set the bar at anything less than 1,000 plays, you don't get any money. That's where the bar is now. But as we mentioned on the last pod where we were talking about Spotify, you know, who's to say that won't move? And I think that's people's fear, isn't it, that it'll go up to 2,000 or 5,000, and where does it end? And once the precedent is set, how difficult is it going to be to reverse that?
Yeah, I mean, there are some examples of these kind of thresholds. So I was looking up PRS for Music, the collecting society. They have a minimum limit of paying out on royalties. I think it's 30 quid for most quarters, where if it's less than that, they don't pay out because it's too small to justify the processing costs, you know. I think even DistroKid has got a minimum payout threshold as well, if you don't earn more than $5 point something. And the other area is kind of places like YouTube and Twitch, where you can upload videos for free. You don't earn any money. And it's only when you get to a certain level, you can join their partner programs and start getting a share of ad revenues. So in a way, it's kind of moving music towards that kind of model, like the model of uploading things to YouTube, which if you're a musician, you might, you know, might understandably think, I don't think that's a good. The other thing I was going to mention actually was Musical. I did a conference recently. We had Deezer's CEO, so Deezer, the streaming service. He spoke and he was asked about this and he was like, well, his basic view was you're making sense if you're getting 1,000 streams. And then that money gets stuck in a distributor. People don't even take it out because it's just 2 cents. And what he was saying was, if you're an up-and-coming artist, what we need to do is help you get discovered, and then you can get to that level. And he was sort of saying, so rather than see us as taking your money away, we need to put the effort into helping your music get to the people who like it. So he seemed to be saying that as we introduce these limits, we're also going to try and give you more tools to help you build an audience. But the proof of that really is in the pudding. If you're taking money away in one sense to say, well, we're going to make things better in another area, you have to then prove it. But yeah, I think it's, I don't know. Honestly, like, I think I defend Graham's right to have his art out there. And I listened to it and I enjoyed it. So I'm glad it is out there. And I sort of, I hope it can find its way to people so that if he wants to earn money, he can. So I really am torn about the impact these changes will have, but I don't take it lightly. Yeah, I don't sort of think it's all great and just sod off if you've got less than 1,000 streams, because there are people who are, it is people's art. But do you know what we need to do? I've thought of a solution to this. We need to get the Grizzly Adams CD into the hands of an NFL executive, right? And say, do you need some new touchdown music? Because song two is, you know, getting on a bit now. And that might be the solution, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've got no contacts in that world. But I would certainly ask around. Alternatively, as you've done, go and stream the Grizzly Adams, and we might be able to push Graham up above the 1,000 mark. Let's, as our first target, we've got to try and earn the £20 for distribution. We'll do that. Anyway, we're out of time. We're out of time partly because I have to head off to pick up an extra microphone so I can interview a band at a gig in London later on. But thank you very much for listening. If you've enjoyed this pod, please do subscribe to the show in your podcast app. Give us a review and a rating if at all possible, because we'd be very grateful if you could. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us, Stuart, at this address.
It's theprice@gmail.com.
Thank you very much to Stuart. Thanks, everybody. Take care of yourselves. Cheerio.
Cheerio.